You're listening to K-Chung Radio. This is Fresh Air with your host, Robbie Herbst. Tonight we've got two special guests coming into the studio, Adam Tennell and Elise Emder. But now, let's start with our theme song. Hello, K-Chung. So tonight, we're actually going to be having our first guest be Elise Emder. She's an artist based in L.A., and tonight we're going to talk about a few of Elise's projects. But first, let's welcome Elise to the studio. Hi, Elise.
Hey, Robbie.
First thing first, though, I picked out a song for you. Let's listen to that song.
Late one cold and stormy night, I heard a dog barking. Then I thought I heard somebody at my door knocking. I wondered who could be outside in such an awful storm. And then I saw a little girl with a puppy in her arms. Before I could say a word, she said, "My name is Sandy, and this here is my puppy dog. Its name is Little Andy." Standing in the bitter cold in just a ragged dress, then I asked her to come in, and this is what she said. "Ain't you got no gingerbread? Ain't you got no candy? Ain't you got an extra bed for me and Little Andy? Pat a cake, a baker's man. My mommy ran away again, and we was all alone and didn't know what else to do. I wonder if you'll let us stay with you. Giddy up, trotty horse, going to the mill. Can we stay all night? If you don't love us, no one will. I promise we won't cry. London Bridge is falling down. My daddy's drunk again in town. We was all alone and didn't know what we could do. We wondered if you'd let us stay with you." She was just a little girl, not more than 6 or 7. That night as they slept, the angels took them both to heaven. God knew Little Andy would be lonesome with her gone. Now Sandy and her puppy dog won't ever be alone. "Ain't you got no gingerbread? Ain't you got no candy? Ain't you got an extra bed for me and
Welcome, Los Angeles citizens, to Fresh Air with Robbie Herbst. My first guest tonight is Elise Emder. Elise, how are you this evening?
A little sleepy, but here.
Well, I'm very excited that you're my first guest on Fresh Air with Robbie Herbst. Today we're going to talk about some of your projects, some of your artwork. It's a very interesting practice you have. I actually want to start talking with you about a long-running project that I understand that you have called My Lifetime Goals. And if I'm not mistaken, and you correct me, My Lifetime Goals is a project where you get people to, mostly kids, to write down their lifetime goals. I was wondering if you can read some of these lists that you've gathered.
Sure. So the first lifetime goal from a fourth grade elementary school class in New Jersey, my lifetime goals. 1, to be a famous artist. 2, to pass the fourth grade and college. 3, to be better at school. 4, to have 1 million friends. 5, to be rich. 6, to not have glasses, have contacts. 7, and last but not least, to work with babies.
I'm wondering, could you read us one more?
Please. Yeah. Lifetime goals, work at a casino. Be young parents. Be a great gambler. Be successful.
These lists are really funny, Elise. So these are little children, fourth graders?
Fourth graders,
that
yeah.
You interview and ask or give them an assignment?
So basically I worked with the teacher and the teacher gave them the assignment. So I asked a teacher to if they could implement this assignment and then collected them.
Do you know anything about a child who has ambitions to be a great gambler?
Yeah, it's South Jersey, you know, just outside of Atlantic City. So I assume that it comes from that. But other than that, it's a mystery.
Are you from South Jersey?
Originally, yes, I am.
Huh. That's interesting. Well, we'll get back to that in a little bit. But I'm wondering if you could tell me Why do you have a why are you interested in lifetime goals?
Yeah, I mean, it was related to another project I did called Show and Tell, in which I filmed first graders sharing the objects that are important to them. And so I was sort of like interested in looking at how the children relate in the school system and how the curriculum is sort of forming their larger selves, I guess.
Wait, I'm confused. You mean, what do you mean by things that are interesting to them? Can you tell me a little clearer?
Oh, of course, yeah. So the Show and Tell, so, you know, it's a very American task that a lot of us Americans can relate to, that we've done in school, which is present our show and tell objects that are special to us, and then tell the class a story about the object, where it came from.
Oh, now I understand. So yeah. In the videos, this is a video project. I saw these videos with little kids showing off their pets.
Their pets, trophies, stuffed animals. So, so I filmed Show and Tell in 6 different public elementary schools across the country in different states. And it was really looking at like what these objects and the stories that the children tell about the objects reveal about, you know, their home life or themselves or the school system. So the lifetime goals was sort of like a precursor to that.
Why, Elise? Why are you interested in little kids writing their... I mean, these children are barely formed, and how is it... Why is it that you're interested in presenting these mundane things like show and tell lists? Show and tell and life lists. What's that about?
Well, I think that it's looking at how this... the lifetime goals, it's like this idea of progression and how that is sort of like informing, I feel like it's like a very American pursuit or something, if that makes sense.
Is America a foreign country to you? it's just very curious. I mean, I think of many authors who look at America as an object of study, and somehow they feel a little alien from the country. To place yourself outside of it, to frame like show and tell or lifetime ambitions, and to frame that as something, you have to have an experience of standing outside of that.
Mm. Well, I mean, I guess perhaps I have an experience of standing outside, but I'm very much an American and this is my home. And, you know, I often like try to think of projects in other countries, and it's really challenging for me. And so I think that these projects come from knowing my home so well.
Wait, what do you mean? You try to think about projects in other countries?
I'll just like try to think of an idea, try to think of ideas for other projects outside of my own country. And because I don't know these other countries, it's like impossible for me.
Could you give me an example of a project you've dreamed up, say for a foreign land? That's kind of interesting.
No, that's what I'm telling you. I haven't. It's totally impossible. My entire scope is like America.
So you had said a moment ago that you you had the experience of standing outside of America at one point, or you have that experience, but you...
I mean, I think it's like a very common experience for artists to at some point in their life feel like an outsider, perhaps when they're children, you know? And so I guess I felt like an outsider. And so a lot of like my documentaries, which they sort of start from looking from the outside and then moving in from that. And so, yeah, that's all I mean by that.
So if I could pry... An outsider? I mean, I was a perfectly well-adjusted young boy.
Well, I was a little shy, but no, actually, when I was like in the fourth or fifth grade, I had this experience in the summertime. My father and I were laying in the lounge chairs by like our pool looking at the stars, and it really freaked me out. Actually, I think it was the first time that I really looked at the stars. And it made me feel totally alienated from my family and from everything. And I had this sort of like big dilemma. And so I think that that's when it started, the feeling like an outsider. But I don't really think that that has so much to do with my work, Robbie. I think you're really prying here.
Thanks, Elise. Another thing I wanted to talk about was a project that you currently have going on right now. And it's a project about photograph. Well, you are collecting images of prison backdrops. That is, literally, there are people with inside of prisons who paint backdrops in which people get themselves photographed in front of. And you're collecting images of these photographic backdrops. So if I could place this a little bit, these are images taken inside of prisons of paintings of the Brooklyn Bridge or a forested scene or a bunch of flashy cars that prisoners will take their photographs in front of. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, you're correct. So in most prisons in America across the country, in the visiting room are featured idealized landscape murals like what you're talking about, and they're almost always painted by inmates, and they're actually used, well, for one, for the inmates to sort of pretend that they're someplace else so that they can give a photograph of themselves to their mom, and their mom can have a photograph of her son in front of a waterfall and then show all of her girlfriends the photograph, and no one will know that her son is in prison. But they're also, what through my research, because I've been working on this project for over 5 years now, and after talking to like prison officials in when I visited prisons, I realized that they're actually used to control the images that are exported out of the prisons. So in other words, the prison administrators think that it's a security risk to have pictures of the prison circulating outside the prison. So the only way to not have pictures of inside the prison go outside is to have all the photographs inside the prisons taken in front of these backdrops so that you don't see what the prison actually looks like. So that's like this whole flip side where in this one sense, the images are used for the inmates to escape in their minds. Mm. But in a physical sense, the administration is using them so that inmates can't escape. Because the administration, when I say security feature, the administration thinks that a picture of a door or a window or a mirror could help assist an inmate in an escape, plan out an escape. They think it could help an inmate plan a physical escape. So I've been working on this project. And so all the portraits are of inmates in front of these backdrops taken by an inmate volunteer. And so the inmates, they'll pay, them and their families will buy a ticket and pay like $2 to $4 for the photograph. Mm. And then it's like, you know, if you think about, there's over 2.5 million American incarcerated today. Many of these people are taking pictures. And so it's like all these portraits are in like the photo albums of families of prisoners. And so these are the images are also like a way to see America's incarcerated population, not through the lens of criminality, but really through like the eyes of their loved ones, because that's who the pictures are taken for.
Hmm. And you went to these prisons, yes?
Yeah, last summer I traveled to 10 of the prisons, and with a large format photograph, I photographed not people posing in front of the backdrops, but the actual portrait studios, ultimately to reveal these contextual details.
Wait, portraits? I'm just a little confused.
So the paintings, the backdrops, are basically the portrait studio in the visiting rooms.
Oh.
And so there's a camera. Sometimes they have lights. Some of these paintings like are roll up and down at the push of a button. And sometimes they're like swapped out every
multiple,
month.
Are there multiple backdrops at once?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
A few of them are like that.
Can you just tell us about one of them?
Yeah, the one in Houtzdale, Pennsylvania, it was basically like all motorized, and there were, I think, 8 or 10 backdrops with like a brick wall, steps, a jungle scene, a beach scene. And anyway, on the wall, when you walk into the visiting room, there are all these little buttons where you can press. You could choose your landscape when you press it, and it goes bzzz.
So what was it like being a visitor in these prisons, taking photographs of this prison landscape, this micro prison landscape?
Yeah, it was wild. I mean, the best part about visiting the prisons was really interfacing with the prison guards and the superintendents and you know, the administration, everyone I saw, because it was like my first time that I could actually like understand their perspective, mm-hmm. you know, because the nature of large format photography, it's just that it's slow. Mm. So even though I was going in to take one or two pictures in each prison, it could take 3 hours to get the shot just right. And so while I was taking the picture, I was talking to all these people. But it was interesting, in Graterford Maximum Security Prison just outside of Philadelphia, I first went in to meet an artist, one of the backdrop painters who I interviewed for the book that's coming out this summer. Anyway, so I first went in the first half of the day to meet this guy in the visiting room, and just like a visitor, and I was treated one way by the guards. And then right after everyone left the visiting room, I run to the car, grab all of my equipment, come back in, and like suddenly looking more professional and was just like treated totally different. So it was really, that was really informative to me, because as a photographer with permission, you know, who with an appointment with the superintendent, it's like people respect you and like treat you a certain way. But then to be able to see how the guards and everyone sort of interacted with me as just like a friend of a prisoner, uh-huh. was different. So that was an interesting thing that I wouldn't have.
I've often heard when of civilians or the non-incarcerated entering as a visitor into the prison system as a visitor, that you begin to feel the oppressive weight of being incarcerated.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how it was like for you to be on the inside in that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this project started originate from a photograph that I found of my own brother in prison and me visiting him. And so I had this experience.
Sorry. So you visited your brother, your brother, is he your age?
So my brother is about 18 years older than me. And so when I was 5 years old, I visited him throughout my childhood for a few years.
And
I visited
him in prison.
He was in Bayside State Prison in Leesburg, New Jersey. And he was in and out of prison for different things, like car theft, particularly. Anyway, so that experience of feeling the reality of prison as such a young person really is affected me, and that's what inspired this project. And so when I went back in recently last summer as an adult, I mean, I still felt it. It was depressing, and especially like going into these prison towns, you know, that were just like the entire industry is prison on this. Cause I visited 10 prisons in like less than 2 weeks.
That was quite a summer trip.
that was quite the summer vacation. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sensitive to like feeling all those things, so it was really heavy for me. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the nature of the entire project is obviously very emotionally taxing for myself. And I think
there's something that I thought about your work, and I'm wondering if you could respond to it. I was thinking that whether you're taking photographs of people who have survived lightning strikes, or whether you are doing a project that is about show and tell, or seniors exercising in a pool, or prisoners trying to improve themselves through physical education or through the arts, much of your artwork is about people who are under duress, or people who are trying to better themselves and seek a kind of improvement. Mm. I'm wondering why that is. What is your interest in people who are under the duress of existence, whether they've broken the law or whether they're aging or whether they've been hit by lightning? And why is it that you're interested in highlighting through your artwork ways that these people try to improve themselves? In one way, your artwork is like, could be seen as a civics lesson. In another way, it's very deep, because it talks about the human condition. So I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I guess what I've learned about my practice as it's gone on is that it's a lot about empathy, or like being the other and then trying to go inside someone else's life. And so for me, I relate to struggle. I think it really like comes down to looking at people in moments of struggle, and then, you know, it's it's inspiring for me to see how people deal with that struggle in their own ways. You know, like for like the Prison Project, for instance, it's like they're totally in prison. They're in prison, literally in prison, and they're like, they're coping. Like, I'm interested in these coping mechanisms of how people survive these struggles. I think that's as much as I can tell you.
Well,
but it's like something that I relate to, and I think viewers can also relate to, is like this struggle.
I want to read something that you wrote. In 2005, I came upon a Polaroid photograph of myself at age 5, posing with my older brother and sister in front of a tropical beach scene in the visiting room at Bayside State Prison in Leesburg, New Jersey. Finding this image and many others of my brother in front of similar landscape backdrops brought back the complex feelings I had a child visiting prison. The project became a way to process my personal history and to relate my experience to much larger societal issues, the prison industrial complex. So there's two things there that are really exciting. One of them is, you know, you're doing this prison backdrop project to explore your own personal relationship to having to visit your brother in prison.
Yeah.
And then the second is that the wider implications of doing a project that focuses on the political issues underlying incarceration. I'm wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about how what were the feelings you had as a 5 year old?
Yeah.
Visiting your big brother in prison.
This is fucked up, you know? That was it was like devastating. A kid doesn't really understand the complexity of it, other than the fact that your brother can't leave with you, you know? But yeah, I don't know. It was just something that really, like, I constantly went back to.
Is your brother still in prison?
No, he's been out of prison for over a decade now. So, yeah.
What is he doing nowadays?
Nowadays he has a family and he's like working as a construction worker. He just moved back to Florida. But it's, you know, prison isn't something that when you leave. It's something that I think stays with you for the rest of your life. And so in many ways, my brother is still, it's still a big part of who he became as an adult. He was young. He went in prison when he was 18 years old, and throughout his 30s was in and out. But it's still really, you know, not trusting people. He's still a bodybuilder. He's always giving me tips. Bodybuilding tips.
What does he tell you to do?
No, he would just like, you know, tell me how to like lift weights and stuff like that. I never really kept up with that. But one of, you know, I was recently, just like in the last year, sort of interviewing him about his experiences in prison.
Uh-huh.
And one of the most touching things that he said to me was that when he was in prison, he felt the most free that he's ever felt in his entire life when he was in prison. And that's sort of like something that I've been trying to wrap my head around.
What do you think he means by that? Because that's, you know, to be the most free that you are in prison, in life, in prison is very contradictory.
I know. Well, I think it means that at one point in his life when he was in prison, he didn't have all the responsibilities and all of the stress of life, you know, of like jobs and taking care of yourself. And, you know, sometimes when you're in prison, it's maybe easier to just like get to know yourself in that way or something. But this is just what my brother said. This doesn't speak to a larger audience, maybe.
What does your brother think about your project of photographing prison backdrops?
He's super supportive, you know? He's always told me, like, about the artistic talent, you know, in prison. And so I think that's what he sees in it.
Does it matter to you if he likes the project or not?
I mean, I hope that he likes the project, you know, but I'm not going to not do it if he doesn't like it. But yeah, it's interesting. It's like this really weird psychological thing where I feel like I'm like trying to relate to my brother, but instead of relating to him directly, I'm like relating to him through all of these other people. So it's kind of like going the long, taking the long road to understand my brother.
Do you think your brother has a, do you want your brother to have a five goals for his life list? If he does, does he have one? Do you know what it is? Could you guess?
That's a good, I don't. Yeah. I'll ask him.
That would be great. And you could come back.
Come back on the show.
Yeah, that'd be really nice. Well, Elise, it's been really nice to speak to you. Can you tell everyone the name of the book that you have and who's publishing it and when it's coming out?
Yeah, the book is Prison Landscapes, and it will be published by Four Corners Books. It will be out in the summer in the UK and in the fall in Los Angeles.
Well, thanks, Elise, and thanks for visiting Fresh Air.
Thank you, Robbie.
Up next, we'll be having Adam Tunnell.
That's why he can do so many amazing things. Many people believe almost any darn thing they're told, especially if it sounds like something they already believe.
Hi, everybody. We're back with Adam Tunnell, or Adam Voitan, or, well, what is your name?
Well, So my name is Adam Tennell, but kind of my punk nom de plume is Adam Vuitton, which is comes from this anarchist variety show that I used to run in Denver with my partner, Kate Kirschenstein. We do everything collaboratively under the name Cake and Eat It. And we ran this anarchist variety show for a couple of years. And we just, one night, we knew that we wanted to do an anarchist variety show, and we were talking about it. And yeah, anyway, the idea of calling it Louis Vuitton Night just came up, and we like literally like laughed our asses off, and like it just thought it was the most hilarious thing to call anarchist variety show Louis Vuitton Night. So that's what we did.
Oh, thank you. Well, the first thing I want to talk with you about is a new project that you have going on called Femme Strike. And you on a website, Cake and Eat It, have this written about this project. Femme Strike, initiated by Cake and Eat It, is a series of temporary union halls throughout Los Angeles investigating the connection between radical unionism and femme organizing. Adam, I'm wondering if you could read a little bit of from your manifesto written on the Femme Strike website.
Well, it's actually not it's not our manifesto. It's a manifesto called Femme Shark Manifesto. It was written by someone else, but I can still read a little part of it if you want.
Who was it written by?
I can't remember the name. Sorry about that.
It's okay. Well, so this was a manifesto written by someone, a friend of yours?
No, it's just somebody that wrote. I'm not sure actually a whole lot. They're a poet.
Okay, so let's go to the manifesto.
And it's just a really beautiful manifesto, just kind of talking about like what femme is and kind of what femme isn't. So it says, "We might be your girl, but we're our own femmes. We recognize that femmes are leaders of our communities. We hold it down, calm your tears, organize the rally, visit you in jail, get child care hooked up, loan you $20. Femmes are welders, after-school teachers, abortion clinic workers, strippers, writers, factory workers, moms, revolutionaries, dedicated to the taking down the system, the hell down so we can be free. Femmes are leaders of taking care of business, defending our queer and trans of color communities. We used our stilettos as weapons at Stonewall." And it goes on and on. It's a really wonderful manifesto. So
we used our stilettos as weapons at Stonewall. But Adam, this is for a union hall project you have.
Well,
what is this union hall project?
Like, the Luddites were actually like started by like throwing heels in the factory machines. It was like women's shoes. And if you look at like the what was it, Sabot, it was like a heel. It was like a really like fancy heel, and they were just like fucking threw it in the
weaving machine. There's some people who may not know what a Luddite is. What do you mean by throwing heels, and who are the Luddites and what are the heels?
Well, during the Industrial Revolution, they were like forcing all of these peasants into factories and then like making them work all of these like intense conditions, like everyone knows. And so like the Luddites were like, fuck that. We're just going to like destroy these machines and just like go back to living. In fact, if you read like The Transgender Warriors by Leslie Feinberg, she has like a whole great thing about like the wives of Luddites, which were all like these trans women that were like had this rebellion against, but they were like associated with the whole Luddite thing, but like they were the wives of Luddites, and they just burned down machines and factories and stuff like that. It was wonderful.
And what century are we talking about?
This is like the 18th century.
Wow, that is a very different way to look at history. But I did want to talk about, so this is a project that involves creating temporary union halls. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's actually, it's the temporary union halls is something that we're working on in terms of like kind of trying to understand what organizing is in and of itself, and take that wherever we can. In fact, I kind of want to plug this like aspect of the Femme Strike if I could.
Please.
Because during the general strike, which is going to be on May Day, Cake and Eat It, which is Kate and I, are planning to put on an opera called Opera Post-Operismo. Or actually, no, sorry, Opera Operismo. Anyway, and so that's going to be a collection of these various like scenes that people construct on like whatever they want to do. If they're singing an aria on top of a barricade, or if they're offering someone a fancy beverage from a bag, or if they're just fancy like beverage. Giving people a back rub or whatever, like we're gonna string those different vignettes together in a way, and then like the opera goers are going to weave through the general strike going from scene to scene.
Can I stop you right here? I'm a little confused about how stringing operas together relates to a union hall. I mean, most Americans think of unions as guys with beer bellies who've spent a day at the shop and have greasy hands, and if they're listening to music, it's either Jay Giles Band or Trailers or Glenn Miller. So how can we connect this queer aesthetic to unions?
Well, all right, so I'm a part of the IWW. And
what is that?
The IWW is like a real classic, like classical union from back in the day.
What does IWW stand for?
Industrial Workers of the World. And around the turn of the century, they were like super active, and they were like, their industrial unionism, which is totally different than trade unionism. But if you hear any like union song, like Solidarity Forever and like all that shit, like that's almost... you can almost guarantee it is from the IWW, because they were like had a huge cultural presence. But at the same time, like the IWW, well, let me just say the IWW is amazing and everybody should join it. But
so you're
like,
saying that the IWW has a different history and different relationship to unionism, say, than the UAW, the United Auto Workers?
Yeah, for sure, because they're really all about rank and file organizing, which is a totally different idea of organizing than having like a bureaucratic apparatus organize you. They're all about like learning how to be an organizer yourself. But at the same time, like the IWW is still very male centered, and so we were trying to figure that out and wondering like what's the deal with this. Like IWW is a great model, especially for precarious workers and thinking about like artists and like all these different like ways that labor is working and we're getting exploited these days. IWW is a great model because it's all about organizing across industries and like working towards a general strike. And so
what does that have to do with this?
We are like, all right, but what's the deal? It's amazing, but at the same time, like, why are all these women like excluded? And so like we started researching it and thinking about it, and like the IWW, and I don't know, I'll make it like a little bit short, because like I have a weird like historical conspiracy theory involving like the Masons and like work as ritual and then like the exclusion of women in the work sphere. But anyway, the point is that actually, yeah, and I'm also really interested in these like Dionysian cults that are like a different way of organizing people and thinking of more of like our like sexuality and like our intimacy as like a form of ritual rather than just like this kind of like industrial like revolutionary model of work. But anyway,
hold on a second. So unions could be Dionysian cults?
To me, not all of Cake and Eat It believes that, but I don't know. It's just something that I'm tripping out on now. But so
okay, let's stop here for a second. So one of the things that I know about the fem strike, I've seen some of these union halls in as art installations, and I actually participated in one during the first day of the occupation at City Hall. But really, what I've seen about it most is a rich graphic history or a graphic developing an image for fem strike around these union halls. And they involve images of police cars exploding, and then machine gun, a t-shirt which has a machine gun on it with hot pink lettering saying, "Some girls fight back," and some woman doing a booty shake dance. So What is this interest that you have with this kind of fucked unionism and bizarre graphics?
Well, the whole idea is that, like, there's something intrinsic to femme culture in and of itself that, like, really facilitates organizing, because if you think about it, like, all, like, aesthetics are really, like, a way to communicate to each other and to create what we're, like, we have this term that we're, like, writing about a little bit, actually, that is called intimate solidarity. And so we really feel that, like, aesthetics and, like, it kind of glamour and this kind of, like, exuberant bejeweling and all of that is like, just, like, a little, like, hint at a different type of, like, organizing, like, a way that you could actually, like, advocate for each other's bodies and think about, like, the spaces that we inhabit and, like, the ways that facilitates, like, relationships. And that, and, like, in fact, that is, like, the root of all organizing, whether it's the IWW and it's just about a bunch, because, like, the IWW was really inspired by hobos. And so, like, the hobo culture and stuff. And, but the hobos were, like, had that down to a T. So, like, they were all about, like, in, like, their own form of intimate solidarity, even though it was, like, really exclusionary for, in particular, women. But so we're saying, like, let's look at, like, what did that, like, hobo culture do that turned into the IWW that's so interesting for us, that says that, like, rank and file unionism is, you know, that created what we know as rank and file unionism. And so what we're saying is that it's like this kind of aesthetic underpinning, this femming, like femme is a verb and all of that kind of thing. So you should look at our Tumblr, you know, what Robbie was referring to, femstrike.tumblr.com. So that's kind of, and that's also one of the inspirations for the opera. We're asking, like, participants to interpret that Tumblr as if it were a libretto, and then create performances based on that.
Well, let's just take a step back here. You're sitting here in this wonderful basement in Chinatown,
the freshest air in Los Angeles,
and you're wearing black combat boots. You have black pants, a crass tube dress. Would you describe that way?
Yeah, I turned it into a tube dress.
Uh-huh. Is it sleeveless?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a tube dress. Yeah, and then on top of that, you have a hot pink jeans jacket that is filled with gold steel spikes and a pat, an IWW patch. So, I know you, Adam, as someone who's very interested in the relationship between fashion and anarchism. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Why?
Well, like I say, I don't really trust an anarchist that's not well-dressed. And the reason is because how are you going to build community with somebody that's shoving cargo pants and ill-fitting t-shirts down your throat every day? It's definitely shows. So, like, I feel like fashion shows a respect for the people that you're, like, your community and the people that you're around. And it's a way to communicate. It's a really visceral and, like, intimate way to communicate between people. I mean, there's obviously problems with fashion, but in terms of, like, you know, capitalism and all of those things. But I used to run Kate and I, with the Cake and Eat It, used to run a free store for forever. And so there's no reason why, like, good fashion has to be expensive.
Well, on that note, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about some of the projects. Well, you could correct me if I'm wrong. On the Cake and Eat It website, there's a list to a bunch of really interesting, bizarre projects. And one of them is, I assume, is at the Free Store. It's a free boutique wrestling event where, well, I'm wondering if you could describe that for everybody.
Yeah, totally. So we did it. We ran a free boutique, which was actually out of a storefront for a year.
Wait,
in Denver.
Okay.
And then after that, we ended up, it was a little bit outside of Denver, in fact, and it was kind of hard to get to. So we ended up transitioning to doing these satellite collections. And so one of the satellite collections we did was at this punk house called the Tea House. And
when you say a punk house, do you mean it was a collective punk, it was a cooperative house?
Yeah, it was just like punk dudes, and they were dirty, I don't know, and kind of punky, and they put shows on there too. And
now, were these straight
typical punk house?
Were these straight punk guys? Were they queer identified? Were they?
I don't know. I don't really want to judge anybody and assume that they're straight. It's, you know, I find that rude. So I never figured out like their actual sexuality. So I just like the wrestling fashion show was kind of like my brainchild. And one of the things I wanted to do was take, a lot of them were activists as well. Like one of them in particular, Noah, is actually a really like heavy minded, like environmental activist. He was arrested and spent a month in jail in Copenhagen for the COP15 protests. So I really wanted to take him and put him in a wrestling singlet and have him wrestle. And he's also kind of a dick and like a, so I just wanted like, but I love him at the same time. So I just wanted to put him in like this red velvet wrestling singlet and have him like roll around with other boys and just see what came of it.
So what came with it? I mean, you get all these, crusty punks together and you glam them up in kind of outrageous wrestling singlets, and it looks, you know, from the documentation that they had a grand old time.
It was wonderful. It was really fun. And not all of those people in it were kind of like Noah's. There was a whole different like group. And they were like all different types of sexuality. So I don't wanna say that like the whole thing was about like taking straight punk activists and making them queer, but that was like a component of it. It was a good time. And I mean, it was kind of like interrogating like masculinity, which was something that I still am really interested in. I used to run a blog called The Boulevardier that was all about looking at like male activist fashion and kind of like dissecting that.
Well, we're running out of time here, but there's a question that I want to ask, which is... these type of events that you do, you're really wrestling with identities around relating to violence and nonviolence that fall into activist circles around taking power in a certain way. And I would imagine activists who come forward with the idea of an alternative form of power readily fall into certain stereotypical notions of power. And you're doing these performances that are presenting these male identities as things that could be played with to maybe decenter this kind of activist culture. And while these events are parties, I'm wondering, do they have a life beyond these moments? Do they affect the community?
In Denver, like all of our work that we did was around like the anarchist community there. And we were really concerned with the permissions that it takes to become an anarchist. And like you're saying, the kind of power dynamics that occur in that and who gets privileged, whose voice gets privileged. And I mean, Denver is really amazing because it was really like queer and trans oriented, but at the same time, it was still very like butch and masculine like driven. And so our whole like purpose is to just take femme and just like stab people with it in their eyes. And so I think that there's a life beyond it, because I really do think that like femming is like a mode of organizing, and you know, the ruling class is totally organized, and the reason why they have power is because they are so much more organized than us, the, you know, working class, or the 499% or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so femming is a tool to use in that regard.
Well, Adam, I want to thank you for joining us at Fresh Air. And we'll be paying attention to May 1st and the Fem Strike. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And that concludes our final, our first broadcast of Fresh Air with Robbie Herbst.
Thank you very much, Robbie.
We're gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna dance and ball and shout together. Na 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 na. We're gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna have a real good time together. We're gonna dance and ball and shout together. Oh baby, please, we're gonna have a real good time together. Na 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 na